Thank you for listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting to you live from Burnaby Mountain.
Welcome to Electronic Intifada Radio. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. On this episode, hunger-striking UK political prisoners learn lessons from Palestine. We hear from the spokesperson from the group Prisoners for Palestine.
Everybody that can continue taking action on the prisoners' behalf to shut down these factories in this country on their behalf, because now they're in prison, they can't do that. These people are hunger striking for justice, for their own justice and for the Palestinian people.
The sister of a political prisoner tells us why her brother is on hunger strike.
How are you supposed to be liberated when there is somewhere across the world a group of human beings that are being killed and being denied the liberation that we can so freely do? He's currently doing remand because of his commitment to the liberation of Palestine.
And a doctor with years of experience working in Gaza tells us about starvation used as a weapon against Palestinians.
Starvation is an assault. It's an attack on people. And it goes back to this very powerful, sophisticated, advanced nuclear power military imposing that on that population.
This is Electronic Intifada Radio. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. This episode highlights the interviews from our podcast on August 18th and December 2nd, 2025. Later in the show, we'll hear about political prisoners in British jails associated with the banned group Palestine Action, who have now been on hunger strike for over a month. They are demanding to be released on bail, the right to a fair trial, and an immediate end to what they say is their persecution by the British government. Most have already been held on remand far longer than the normal six-month maximum, which the law allows before trial. We'll join Shahmina Alam, the sister of Kamran Ahmed, one of the hunger strikers, and Francesca Nadine, a spokesperson from the new group Prisoners for Palestine. But first, forced and sustained starvation is shaving years off of Palestinians' lives, especially children, whose cognitive and growth development is dependent on good nutrition in their earliest years. In August 2025, I spoke with Dr. Thaer Ahmed, an emergency room physician from Healthcare Workers for Humanity, who has worked extensively in Gaza about Israel's use of starvation as a key weapon in the genocide. He joined us from Chicago. Dr. Thaer, welcome to Electronic Intifada Radio.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
I want to spend some time talking with you about starvation and what it means in terms of how it affects the body. Tell us about how starvation occurs and the physiological effects of this policy, Israel's policy of plunging Gaza into this crisis.
Starvation is an assault. It's an attack on people. So this is something that is far beyond just depriving people of the food that they need. That's the first way to understand this. How is this assault being manifested? It's in the total obstruction of food entering. It's the total restriction of food getting into the Gaza Strip. So understanding that, what you're seeing on the ground right now is that's happening in a context of unclean water, unreliable access to water, as well as overcrowding and conditions that are allowing disease to spread between person to person at a very rapid rate. The first signs of which are, of course, people are reporting that they are losing weight unintentionally. This is not somebody that's going on a diet. These are people who are trying to go about their day that are losing weight at a rate that is unsettling. And one thing that most Palestinians and Gazans will show you, they'll show you pictures before the genocide and they'll show you pictures now. And they look like completely different people. For any public health professional, that's very alarming when they're starting to tell you, this is unintentional. I didn't do this because I wanted to do this. This was forced on me. That is like the first thing that we are able to recognize. We are seeing that people have lost a tremendous amount of weight, that the muscle that they once had is wasting. The most extreme examples of this would be looking at people who are bodybuilders in Gaza, and there was more than a fair share of them. You see pre and post, and it shows you what happens to the muscles. I mean, they're just basically vanishing before your eyes. And of course, that corresponds to people having decreased energy levels, people's blood sugar levels are decreasing, their inability to tolerate different temperatures, that starts to manifest. It's really hard in the winter times when you're being starved, your body's not able to generate the heat that it needs. If you've ever gone outside when it was really cold, you tighten up, you know? And so if you're losing some of that muscle that allows you to tighten up and try to create more of that heat on your body, what happens? You have hypothermia, and that starts to affect your heart rate. It can affect your blood pressure. It can cause all sorts of things. And so I think that's probably like these sort of initial physical effects that you start to see in people. And when you start looking at children who we would describe as vulnerable populations, you know, anybody that you really want to protect from this because they don't have the same adaptability as normal, healthy adults. You think about kids who are breastfeeding. You think about children under the age of 6 months, under the age of five, really, or children who are premature. You think about pregnant women or breastfeeding women. You start to think about the elderly. You think about people with diabetes or high blood pressure, all of these things, people with medical conditions. These people, this happens at a more accelerated rate, and they struggle with this a lot more. The sort of consequences that this has on somebody is, I think, what's particularly concerning. Because as you're losing muscle, as you're losing your ability to regulate the temperature of your body, as you are growing weaker and with more fatigue and less energy, and you can't maintain your blood sugar levels, what that puts you at risk for is that your immune system is not going to be able to mount the sort of response that it needs to for regular infections, for upper respiratory infection like a cold, the common cold. That means that they will have it longer than they typically would if these weren't the conditions that were in place. That means that they will get sicker, and that means that they're at higher risk for this to cause some serious morbidity and mortality. They could potentially die as a result of this. And that is a preventable, unnecessary death, all because there is a policy over time where you are restricting the amount of food that was entering and the sort of starvation that we're seeing. Then the other thought that you think about is, okay, so we're noticing that we're putting them at risk, that they are struggling, that they're not going to be able to handle additional insults. Well, we cannot ignore the fact that there are fighter jets that are dropping bombs on these people, and that is doing it in an indiscriminate fashion. And so while you are being starved and you're struggling with this, that means that if you were to miraculously survive an airstrike, that you are going to be at high risk for not being able to heal properly, potentially dying as a result of an infection, as we mentioned, but also that your body is not going to be able to heal the way that it normally would heal. So permanent disability as a result of this situation that that's been thrust upon you. That's kind of like the immediate effects that you're starting to notice, the things that really concern you. And the reason you want to identify this in children especially is because they are still developing, they're still growing, and you know that every day that passes that they are under these conditions of malnourishment, especially the severe ones, you are gambling with their future. They have cognitive issues that will develop as a result of this that will be irreversible. They will have short statures compared to what they would have normally been able to grow to, and even developmental delays, not reaching the classic milestones that we see kids reach. And that's sort of, you know, something that I think is alarming enough. But again, just to sort of get deeper into this, what we're doing is we're shaving years off of their lives on the back end. These kids are at higher risk to develop chronic diseases, you know, hypertension, diabetes, heart disease, cancer. So the life expectancy changes. When you hear the words balanced diet and getting all of the food groups, exposure to the food groups, that's not happened consistently over 22 months. And it all becomes interconnected, right? When you talk about ecocide, the agricultural opportunities on the fertile land that existed there is being decimated, not just for the interim period right now as this war on the civilians of Gaza rages on, but that sort of effect persists for a very long time, that you can't just suddenly grow crops the day that the fighter jets land and stop, you know, scrambling above head. That is concerning. That's a public health emergency. Again, it's because the Israeli military is maintaining a suffocating siege while also devastating the population with their military. So all of that kind of works together against the civilians in Gaza. Everything is working against their ability to sort of succeed and to thrive. We see that there is a rise of people who are dying as a result of the severe malnutrition and the starvation. And that's the other thing that I think is important to put into the historical context that Palestinians, especially in Gaza, exist under. So if we have a siege from 2006 that has been implemented, where at various points you have ministers that have said things like, we need to put the Gazans on a strict diet, and things like different food items are being banned from entering. So just deciding that there are certain food items that will not be allowed to enter, that can help you better understand how this population may be sicker than the population that's only a few miles away in Tel Aviv. I think you have to put it in that context. You know, the sort of impact that occupation, apartheid, and escalations have on our vulnerable populations, it doesn't go away. And then when you have a horrifying genocide unfolding, then you are seeing it almost be put on steroids, and you see just how far you can push the body's breakdown. And it goes back to this very powerful, sophisticated, advanced nuclear power military imposing that on that population that's there.
Thank you so much, Thaer.
Appreciate you. Thank you.
That was an excerpt from my conversation with emergency room physician Dr. Thaer Ahmed with Healthcare Workers for Humanity. You're listening to Electronic Intifada Radio with me, Nora Barrows-Friedman. 29 political activists associated with the banned group Palestine Action are in British jails. Most have already been held on remand far longer than the normal six-month maximum, which the law allows before trial. Six of these political prisoners have now been on hunger strike, some for well over a month. One of the hunger strikers, Kamran Ahmed, was hospitalized on November 25th due to the effects of the hunger strike on his body, but discharged 3 days later. Shahmina Alam, Kamran's sister, and Francesca Nadine, a spokesperson from the new group Prisoners for Palestine, joined the Electronic Intifada's Asa Wynn Stanley on December 2nd, 2025.
In August 2024, a group of Palestine Action activists allegedly smashed through the gates of an Elbit weapons factory in Filton, near Bristol, in the west of England. Once inside, they proceeded to do what Palestine Action always did, take direct action to smash up the deadly tools of the Israeli manufacturer on British soil. Several activists were arrested on the spot, and over the following weeks and months, a group of others were hunted down and rounded up. The total number of political prisoners arrested and held on remand after the action has now reached 24. The Filton 24, as they're now known, have become a major focus for campaigners in the UK for freedom of political prisoners for Palestine. Since the group began in 2020, Palestine Action's campaigns have been so successful that they managed to close three Elbit arms factories, in addition to the firm's London headquarters. Earlier this month, one of the Filton 24, Sean Middleborough, absconded from a short conditional release for his brother's wedding and did not return to Wandsworth Prison in London. In an exclusive statement released to the Electronic Intifada, Middleborough said that he had been, quote, held as a political prisoner of Israel in a British prison and was therefore simply being sensible by refusing to return to jail. His current whereabouts remain unknown, but if we count Sean as one of the Filton 24, since he's not truly free until he's formally released, there are currently 29 British political prisoners held on remand pending charges related to Palestine Action. Their detention period has long gone past the standard pre-trial custody limit. In July, Palestine Action was, of course, infamously banned as a quote-unquote terrorist group by Britain's Labour government, which in itself is deeply tied to the pro-Israel lobby. The ban is currently being challenged in Britain's High Court, with the decision on that expected in the new year. But even before the ban, the Filton 24 were being treated like terrorists by the authorities. And since the ban, their conditions of treatment have rapidly eroded and they've been denied basic legal rights. Due to their increasingly desperate situation, six of the political prisoners have resorted to hunger strikes. Two have been hospitalised And questions about the hunger strikers have been raised in Parliament by your party lawmakers, Zara Sultana and Jeremy Corbyn, who both wrote to Justice Minister David Lammy in recent weeks. To discuss all this, we've got two special guests on the show today. Francesca Nadine is a former Palestine Action political prisoner herself and is now a campaigner for prisoners' rights. She's a spokesperson for the group Prisoners for Palestine. Shamina Alam is the sister of Cameron Ahmed, who is one of the Filton 24 and is currently on hunger strike. Welcome to the show, both of you. Thanks for joining us.
Hiya, thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you so much for inviting us today.
Francesca, of course, I want to talk about the hunger strikers, but first, let's set the scene a bit. You yourself are a former political prisoner who was previously held on remand in relation to allegations stemming from a successful Palestine Action campaign against Barclays Bank. You also had been held on remand until you were finally released on bail in March this year, I understand, and your trial is expected to take place in January, is that right?
So I was remanded, yes, after a Barclays action, but the trial that I had already this year in May was for an action at a factory called Teledyne, an American arms company that makes parts for the F-35 fighter jet that's used in Israel, amongst other things. But it was after this Barclays action that I got remanded, and that's the trial that I have in 2027, yes. So I've been punished twice over already for the first action, and I'm still waiting for my punishment for the second one.
So the Barclays trial, did you say 2027? So it's not for another year, a year and a month?
It's quite normal. Unfortunately, the way that things are at the moment, the court system, the so-called justice system, is an absolute shambles. And there's many, many people that have to wait years for their trials. And Filton 24 and the Brize Norton 5 are just one example of that.
You wrote two articles for the Electronic Intifada while you were in jail, letters from political prisoner. You wrote those from before Palestine Action was banned. But even before the so-called terrorist ban, could you tell us what your treatment was like? I mean, you know firsthand what the British prison system is like, and you know firsthand what it's like to be treated as a prisoner associated with Palestine Action. Talk about your experience a bit.
Well, of course, the sentencing, the treatment of protesters has been deteriorating for many years in this country. They've become more and more draconian, and that goes for climate protesters as well as pro-Palestine protesters. So being held on remand for such a long period of time without a conviction, when I was obviously no risk to the public, was completely unjustified. And of course, when you go to prison, it's a really grim place for everybody. I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy. It's just a place that's designed to break people's spirit. And there's, you know, people survive it in different ways. Unfortunately for me, I'm very outspoken. And because of my political opinions, which I quite openly expressed towards the prison staff, that meant that I had special treatment. But I always wore it as a badge of honour. If I was getting punished by them, it meant I was doing something right. But I got lucky, that's the truth, because this was before the time that people were accused of terrorism. So I was accused of the same thing as the Filton 24s, the Brize Norton 5, which is property damage. But just by pure luck, I got sent to prison a few months before this word started getting used. So I remember it really well when I was in my prison cell getting the news of first it was the Filton 6, then it was the Filton 18, then it was the Filton 24, and the numbers just kept going up and up. And I couldn't believe it. It was really just unexpected, the scale of it. You know, I had an idea that something like this might be coming. There were indications from the government, for example, from Lord Walney, who was recommending this kind of thing.
For viewers and listeners, so-called Lord Walney is John Woodcock, the disgraced former Labour MP, who's somehow touted by the mainstream media as some sort of expert on terrorism, when really he is one of the country's most notable pro-Israel lobbyists.
So, yes, all of a sudden there were lots of people in prison and I had lots of people to write letters to. So I felt like I got to know a lot of my comrades in prison without ever actually meeting them. So when I got out of prison, it was an opportunity for me to continue supporting them from the outside. And that's what I've strived to do in any way possible, and will continue to do, obviously.
Shamina, I want to come on to you in a minute, of course, to talk about Cameron. But maybe before I do that, I could ask Francesca, ask you to set the scene, the context for what's happening at the moment in the country in terms of the political prisoners and the hunger strikes. Francesca, you're a spokesperson for a group called Prisoners for Palestine, which is, I believe is a fairly new group working to support the political prisoners. Tell us about the work of your group and what is happening at the moment with the hunger strikers. How many people are on hunger strike? How long have they been on hunger strike?
There was a real feeling that I got from some of the letters from some of the people in prison, of frustration of the fact that when you're locked up in a tiny prison cell and you see a genocide continuing, you're not able to do anything to prevent that. So this frustration culminated as, you know, starting these conversations and this collective in order to continue organizing collective resistance, even from inside the prison cell. And there's lots of different ways to do this. And of course, a hunger strike is the most drastic form of resistance that can take place in a prison cell. But when the hunger strikers told us that they wanted to do that, of course, we told them that we would support them all the way. And that's what we're here to do now, to amplify their voices, to support their demands, to make sure that they're met. And this started on the 2nd of November, on the commemoration of Balfour Day, of course, a very important day over here. As you can imagine, and as Shamina will explain, their health is deteriorating now in quite a serious way. Despite that, the government is still failing to engage with the process of negotiations, with the demands. We have sent letters to the Home Office, because, of course, it's the Home Office that are responsible for giving these demands, because it's the Home Office that are behind this whole witch hunt of the people in prison and of a wider movement of pro-Palestinian protest in this country. So there are five demands. They're all very reasonable and things that would be granted in any so-called democracy, but it's not happening here. And that's why the people on hunger strike feel that they have no other choice but to take this action, because all of the legal avenues have failed.
So tell us the five demands.
The first one, and this is directed at the general public, and for the prisoners, it's the most important one, that is to shut Elbit down. So everybody that can continue taking action on the prisoners' behalf to shut down these factories in this country on their behalf, because now they're in prison, they can't do that. The next demand is no censorship in prison. So there's been an extreme level of censorship as a result of the political opinions and actions of the prisoners, as a result of this terrorist designation with no justification, with no evidence. The third demand is immediate bail. So as you mentioned, most of the people in prison have been held over the 6 month time limit. They don't meet the conditions to be remanded in the first place, and they don't know when they'll be sentenced or if even they'll be found guilty. Number four is the right to a fair trial. So obviously, this is not happening because there's been constant lies and slander by government ministers, by the mainstream media. And as we know from the great reports by Declassified, there's lots of undisclosed meetings that have been going on with Elbit Systems, different British state actors and the Israeli lobby as well, in which they specifically mention Palestine action and remanding people who've taken action. Demand number five is deprescribe. So there's a huge campaign around this at the moment, obviously. Lots of people getting arrested in the street for holding up signs. And alongside that, drop the terror link that is being put on these cases, again, without any justification or any evidence. So we're seeing that there's almost a complete blackout in the mainstream media about this story. And this is a very significant story in many senses. So we have to ask ourselves a question. Why is this story being blocked? Why do we get these conversations with a lot of different journalists saying that for some reason it's being blocked by their bosses? It seems very suspicious to me.
You have had conversations with mainstream journalists about this, and then the stories have not actually transpired. Is that what you're telling me?
That's exactly right, yeah. On various occasions, I can see a pattern emerging here where it gets blocked by editors or lawyers. So, you know, there are suspicions around that. We'll see how that continues. But obviously, you know, that there are a lot of interests here by the establishment in this story not becoming widespread news, because then there will be public pressure to grant these demands. There will be widespread public support. And they can't allow that to happen, because that will be a loss for Elbit Systems. Everybody can talk about the BBC. It's very well known that throughout this genocide, they have had extremely biased coverage. They have been actively involved in this media cover-up. They are a propaganda tool of the British state, which is a very close ally of Israel. So it's obvious, isn't it, what's happening here? They'll do anything they can to silence any story that has to do with people fighting for Palestinian liberation.
The story came out in the grey zone, the UK grey zone, by Kit Clarenberg and an Australian journalist called William Evans, I believe, about the DSMA notice committee, which for our non-British viewers and for many British viewers and listeners as well who might not know, the D-Notice Committee is essentially a system of military censorship of the British media, where it's a supposedly voluntary system, but it wields a great degree of influence over the British media of what can and can't be broadcast in or printed in the British media. And some files came out through the Australian government really showing the extent of this. I believe the files date from before Palestine Action, but nonetheless, it shows some of the topics that were censored in there include British Special Forces involvement in Syria and so on and so forth, things like that. There's some really alarming stuff in that story. So, you know, it would not surprise me to find out if there have been in the future, we will more than likely probably find out, then there may well have been similar denotices imposed on Palestine Action coverage by the British media. I wouldn't be surprised. I am alarmed, but not entirely surprised to hear you say that. Let's talk about a concrete example then of the hunger strikers. Shamina, your brother Cameron is one of the Filton 24 political prisoners and is currently on hunger strike. So talk about his case, if you would. I mean, you know, you may be restricted in some of the things you can talk about, but, you know, whatever you feel like talk about his arrest, talk about how he's being treated right now and talk about his current condition.
Me and my family keep talking about how insane that feels, like to be without food. I could barely cope without food for half a day. Like we're Muslims, we fast, and like even to do like half a day of fasting, by the end of it, you're wanting to eat, you're wanting to break your fast. And for him, he's like on an open-ended fast that's going on forever with no end sight at the moment. So yeah, to say it out loud, even for him earlier when we were talking about it, he was like, has it been 3 weeks? Because time is just, I think it's slower. It's been slower since these guys have been on hunger strike. Yeah, you feel every minute.
And it seems like you're regularly in contact with him. How is he doing? Is he in high spirits? Is he optimistic? What is the feeling from inside right now?
I think it's a bit mixed. I will say one thing like that defines Cameron's character, and I would say for all of the hunger strikers, is they're so strong, like strong in their mind. They know what they want. And they know that these demands, they're not anything that they're asking which is eccentric or extra. These are all things the government should have been doing, essentially, not just for them, for the British public, but they haven't been met. And so now they're using their bodies and putting it on the line to have these demands met. And because they believe so strongly in getting those and the autonomy of their body, it's powering them through. So whenever I hear Cameron talk about how he's feeling, every single time, he sounds upbeat. It's like he's the one trying to keep me happy. And I'm like, how are you doing that? You're the one with no food. But it's how he's always been. He's very determined to make sure that these demands are heard and things are gone out publicly. And it's all part of, at the end of the day, he's currently doing remand because of his commitment to the liberation of Palestine. And this is just another commitment he's making for the liberation of Palestine. during the march, I had someone come up to me with a message from some Palestinians on the West Bank.
Was this in London, the solidarity demonstration, the national march in London? Yeah.
And someone came up to me, I won't give the name